Chapter 29. Christina. Capri, Italy, October 1891. Liliana pads across the Persian rug and the polished floor tiles of the sitting room in her house slippers, frowning at the impatient rapping of the door knocker. Outside, the iron gate to the lane rattles. She opens the door, but whoever had been knocking so urgently just moments before is gone. A package, rolled in brown paper and tied with string, lies on the loggia's terracotta tiles. Tucked under the string is a letter, sealed with red wax, addressed Tina. Christina throws herself on her bed and tears at the package. Inside is Harry's painting of her, sitting forever in the sun of a Caprese afternoon. She drops it onto the bed and breaks the seal of the letter. Several British banknotes tumble into her lap.
My lovely Tina, I am so sorry. You are everything to me, but it is impossible for me to be everything to you. I am certain you will find it difficult to understand, but my situation is such that it is impossible for me to marry you in your condition. My family would never accept it, and my father would be certain to cast me out without a penny. Then, my lovely siren, what sort of husband would that make me? A Sunday painter without a penny to his name? I don't hail from a normal family. I told you when we met that father is an earl. Mummy is the daughter of a baronet, and I am to inherit the earldom one day, so I absolutely must stay on my best behaviour. I do, in fact, have an understanding with a young woman who is the daughter of a marquis in Yorkshire, to marry her when I've graduated from Sandhurst. It isn't love, of course. Not like us. It's simply the way things work in my world. You do understand, don't you, my darling? I'm leaving for Naples today, and then on to Greece and Turkey. I've left you £20, which I hope you will find useful. I wish only that it could be more, but my father has set a limit on my budget, and would ask far too many questions were I to ask for an advance. I shall never forget you, my beautiful Tina, and wish you and the child the very best in the future. But please, I must ask that you make no effort to contact me or reveal my identity as the father. I should very much wish not to have to deny such a thing, which I know would be very hurtful to you. Your affectionate Harry.
The letter slips out of her hand. Nausea rises from her stomach into her throat. Soon her whole body is overtaken by violent shaking. She makes an effort to stand, though her legs shake like rubber.
Stefania! She screams.
She's halfway to her bedroom door when her legs buckle beneath her. She feels hands under her arms and hears Liliana's shrill Italian vowels. Someone holds her head over a chamber pot as she heaves. Stefania wipes Christina's face with a cool cloth, and she and Liliana help her over to the bed. Liliana shoves aside the painting with an angry curse, knocking the banknotes and letter onto the carpet. When Christina's weeping finally settles into an exhausted sleep, and Liliana disappears to the kitchen with the chamber pot, Stefania collects the letter and the banknotes from the tiled floor. When she finishes reading, she slips it into her skirt pocket with the money. She looks over at her young cousin, and from within the deepest reaches of her Catholic soul, she curses Harry Grenville and all of his descendants to the bowels of hell. Chapter 30. Etta. Dover Ferry Port, England, November 1914. Dover Ferry Port heaves with khaki-uniformed soldiers, weeping women, and commanders bellowing orders through tin megaphones to the continuous flow of men disembarking from the London trains onto the new Admiralty Pier. Gulls, drawn like magnets to the confusion of activity, add their squawks and cries to the cacophony, as they dive and hover over the crowd in search of a carelessly held biscuit or roll. Berthed alongside the pier, a modest two-stacked steamer ferry sits benignly in the cold water of the English Channel, awaiting its next passengers en route to the Western Front. Carlo waves at Etta from the direction of the ferry as he pushes through the throng. "Come, Etta. I found us some seats. We must hurry." Etta picks up her carpet bag and steps out from under the meagre protection of the station's new wooden canopy. She hastens towards Carlo's disappearing figure.
"Push it, miss. Mind how you go."
Etta gasps and stops short as a file of stretcher bearers breaks through the crowd, carrying their cargo of men with mangled bodies towards the ambulance train. A station master with a thick grey moustache knocks the tobacco from his pipe on a metal pillar.
"Just look what those bloody hands have done to our lads. Some place called Wipers. Been like this for weeks. Doesn't look to me like this war will be over by Christmas."
Carlo grabs hold of Etta's arm. "Etta, you must come now. This may be our only chance." Etta turns to look back at the soaring white chalk cliffs and the turreted castle sitting high above the town.
"Etta, Etta, look at me. I can support you in Italy. We shall marry as soon as we reach Napoli. We shall be a family there. I promise you this, Etta mia. But I won't make you come with me if you don't wish it."
Etta looks at Carlo, at his dark eyes flashing with emotion. The past few weeks are a blur of tears and secrets. Jessie will find her note when she is back from the hospital in the morning. She will wake their parents and Celie. There will be a phone call to Amiga, worried conversations with Cousin Roger and Violet, who will know nothing about the escape to Italy. By then, she and Carlo will be leaving their hotel in Paris, en route to the Gare de Lyon to take the train to Rome. She will sit in the taxi, holding Carlo's hand, and watch the buildings and people of Paris pass by the window, on her way to her new life with a man she loves.
"Yes, Carlo, I'm ready."
Part 3, 1915. Chapter 31. Celie, Hither Green, London, January 1915. Celie clips a soldier's portrait to the string in the darkroom. She looks at the soldier's smooth young face, at the eager smile he has been unable to contain, and sighs. Gerald peers over the top of his spectacles from the sink where he is swishing a photograph through a water bath.
"What is it, pet? You've been quiet all day."
Celie sits on a stool beside the work table.
"I feel so lost, Papa. Everything that I've worked toward for the past few years, it's all disappeared."
Mrs. Fawcett has suspended the suffragist meetings for the time being, and no one wants to employ a German teacher now. Even the Home Office Translation Bureau has turned me down. I think my name put them off.
"What? Fry?"
"Cecilia."
"I see. Perhaps you could help your mother knit socks and scarves for the Red Cross."
"Me and Mama knitting? How long do you suppose it would take before she stabbed me with a knitting needle?"
Gerald peers at his daughter over the top of his spectacles.
"You do know your mother loves you, Celie. Very much."
Celie shrugs.
"I guess."
"My dear, sweet girl, you are everything to both of us. You are kind and sensitive. Didn't this Mrs. Fawcett pick you out of everyone to help her with the society? And you are a marvellous photographer. I've seen your photographs at the suffragist march. You have an eye for a story, Celie. You see the things others miss."
"Thanks, Papa."
"You can always reapply to the Translation Bureau in a few months. Things change."
"Like how the war was meant to be over by Christmas, Papa? It's January, and it's still raging.
There's nothing but terrible news in the papers every day from the front. Jesse says the hospital is heaving with wounded soldiers. I feel terrible for them, of course, but I feel terrible about the German boys, too. The whole situation is simply awful. I feel so useless.
Gerald hands Seely a dripping photograph with a pair of metal tongs.
You're worried about young Max Fisher.
Seely glances at her father as she clips up the photograph. I expect he's at the Western Front now, if he's still alive.
I'm sure he's clever enough to keep himself from harm.
It isn't about being clever, is it, Papa? It's about luck. I don't know what to do. I write him all these letters, but I can't send them anywhere. I can't tell anyone about him, because he's German. Every battle victory for our side I read about in the papers fills me with dread. Is that an awful thing to say?
Under the circumstances, it's understandable, Dove.
He picks up a photograph with the tongs and submerges it in the water bath.
There's much to worry about at the moment.
You're thinking about Etta, aren't you? Gerald rubs his forehead.
Yes.
The photograph slips out of the tongs and slides to the bottom of the sink.
Oh, Etta, my darling girl, what have you done?
She'll be fine, Papa. A letter said that she's with Carlo and his family in Naples, and they had a lovely small wedding there before Christmas. She'll be safe there. Mama's written to tell her to go to Cousin Stefania in Capri if she has any problems.
Yes, of course. I'm glad she has a relative nearby.
Papa?
Yes, Pet?
Before he left for Germany, Max asked me to marry him. I said yes.
Gerald looks at his daughter. He loves all of his daughters, of course. But Seely is far more able and intelligent than many of the men he has encountered in his life. She simply needs to learn to believe in herself and her own strength. She is like the Christina he first met all those years ago, when she walked into his father's photography studio in Baker Street. Christina had changed over the years. The softness and vulnerability that had made him want to protect her and love her had hardened into a shell of practicality and a single-minded desire to keep the girl safe and secure at all costs. He would always love her, no matter what. He simply wished he could find a way to make her look at him with love rather than resigned acceptance. Love is important. If Seely has found love with this young German, who is he to stand in their way? He reaches out and squeezes Seely's hand.
Mama and I both know. Etta let it slip on Harvest Sunday. We've been waiting for you to tell us yourself. Max is a very fortunate young man.
Thank you, Papa.
You know, Pet, he asked me for your hand in marriage when he was here for your birthday last year.
He did.
He said he loved and respected you and wanted to do everything the right way. I told him that if you said yes, then I would have no objection whatsoever.
Seely throws her hands around her father. Thank you, Papa. He pats her awkwardly on her back.
You are my own best girl, Seely. Max is a very lucky young man indeed.
Seely counts out the last of the coins from the till and slides them into a cloth bag. £9, 6 shillings and 4 pence, Papa. Putting the portraits of the soldiers in the front window is certainly drawing them into the studio.
Excellent. Put a pound in the box for the Red Cross, would you? Already done.
She ties the string on the bag and slips it into the safe. Gerald beckons her over to his battered oak desk.
Come over here, Seely. I want to show you something.
He unties the ribbon from around a large red cardboard portfolio and carefully opens it to the front page. Seely leans over his shoulder.
Goodness, is that Jessie, Etta and me at the waterfall near Keld in Yorkshire? That's right. 3 years ago now. That was a lovely holiday, wasn't it? He flips over the page. Three yellowing photographs of a young woman in a long dark dress and a flowered hat, posing, rather serious-faced, on rustic wooden bridges and in tree-lined country lanes, having been carefully pasted under a scribbled title, Record of a Tandem Trip Through Kent and Sussex. I took these of your mother the summer after we married. We took a short trip in the countryside. You see here, that's a boatman's house by a small lake near Penshurst, and in this one she's on the wooden footbridge at Ecclesbourne Glen. Seeley leans over the sepia photographs. Where was I? I was born in May, the year after you and Mama married. Didn't you bring me with you? Gerald flips through the heavy paper pages. We left you with my mother for a week. But I must have been only a couple of months old. And I was a few months early. Weren't you worried about me? He reaches a large photograph of King Edward VII and Queen Alexandra in full royal dress. He taps the king's pointed grey beard. I took this at Buckingham Palace. Queen Alexandra was a beautiful woman. Very kind, though she could barely hear a thing. Buckingham Palace? When did he take that? Back in 1905. There are more. He flips the page. Another photograph of the monarchs, this time in street clothes, in an elegant sitting room. I was one of the court photographers, just like your grandfather Fry had been. Some of his photographs are in here as well, of Victoria and her family. I had no idea, Papa. Gerald closes the portfolio and ties the ribbon. Seeley, I've been thinking a great deal about things since I had the fever. About the business, and what would happen were I to... Don't even think those kind of thoughts, Papa. I must think these thoughts, my dear. I have responsibilities. You needn't worry about us. Perhaps not, but I'm your father. I do. Seeley, sit down and hear me out. I have a proposal for you. Seeley sits in the wooden chair beside the desk. What is it, Papa? I'd like you to work in the studio twice a week, taking portraits. Not just as a helper, but as a proper assistant. I've seen how the soldiers relax when you're here in the studio. I know that the portraits you took today will be excellent, very likely better than mine. I shall pay you as I would any assistant, and I shall teach you everything I know about photography. He opens a drawer and takes out the Soho reflex camera and sets it on the desk beside the portfolio. Your Brownie is a fine little camera, but this is much better. I've adapted it with a film roll holder, which will be much easier than plates when you're out and about. Consider it yours. Papa! Get out and about in London. Take photographs of whatever you wish. Think about the story you wish to tell, the composition. Find out whether you prefer taking photographs of people, or flowers, or cities, or whatever. You have a talent, Seeley. I saw it in your photographs of the suffragist march. What do you say? Will you be my photography assistant? Seeley's heart quickens as she picks up the camera. She runs her fingers over the smooth black leather. I say, yes, Papa. Chapter 32. Jessie and Seeley. King's College Hospital, London, May 1915. Jessie skirts around the orderlies, wheeling extra beds into her ward. The beds are so close together that she can only move between them sideways. Some of the soldiers have faces burnt so badly from flamethrowers that their own mothers wouldn't know them. And others, young men barely 20 years old, if that, pat the sheets where a missing limb should have been. By far the majority cough and wheeze and call out for water for their perpetual thirst, victims of the chlorine gas at Ypres. She steps past the crush of orderlies, nurses, and the eager but inexperienced VADs, women in the voluntary aid detachment
who joined as trainee nurses, and whom Matron looks upon as a necessary and entirely regrettable evil, and hurries into the hallway in search of clean linen.
"Sister, water, please."
Jessie stops beside a bed, which has been left between the wall and a set of swing doors. The soldier attempts to prop himself up on his right elbow, but his arm shakes so badly that he abandons the idea and falls back on the bed. The left side of his face and his hands are bandaged, and the right side of his face is bruised and swollen.
"Whatever are you doing here?" Jessie says.
"I'll see we get you into a ward as soon as we can. I'll bring you water, don't worry."
"You're Jessie Fry, aren't you?" "It's me, Frank Jeffries." "Frank? Good grief, how are you?"
Frank attempts a smile.
"I've had better days. I'm sorry, that was a silly thing for me to say." "Don't worry."
Frank's shoulders shake, and his body convulses into a fit of coughing. When it subsides, he runs his tongue over his swollen lips and swallows with some effort.
"The doctor said I should be all right in a few weeks. The burns aren't that bad. Superficial, he said. The Canadians had the worst of it. Poor fellows, didn't know what hit them."
"There are quite a few Canadians here. They said the gas came at them like a strange yellow-green cloud. They'd never seen anything like it.
It smelled awful, like burning metal. Fellows were dropping all around me. I don't know how I managed to make it out."
He gasps from the effort of speaking and presses his hand against his mouth as the coughing takes hold again.
"Let me get you that water, Frank. I'll be right back."
Jessie grabs a glass from a cupboard in the nurse's kitchenette and fills it with tap water. Elsie looks up from the table where she's sipping a cup of tea.
"You're in a rush."
"There's a fellow I know in a bed in the middle of the hallway. He was gasped at Ypres."
"Who is it?"
"Frank Jeffries, from the auction house that sold my grandfather's furniture. My mother's been trying to marry him off to one of my sisters for years.
Why's he been put in the hallway? He'll never get any rest there." "Matron's orders. There's no more room in the wards."
"What about the private rooms upstairs? They're empty."
"They're for wounded officers, Jessie. We can't put ordinary soldiers up there, you know that."
"That's simply ridiculous. We can't have our soldiers queued up in the hallways with the lights on all night and people rushing about when there are perfectly good beds up in the private rooms."
"I agree with you, but those are the rules."
"The rules are in us."
In the corridor, Jessie flags down a harried orderly.
"Stanley, you need to move the soldier in the hallway into one of the private rooms upstairs this evening, once it's not so busy."
"But I was told..." "Who authorised that?"
"Matron."
Celie looks up from the wooden table in the kitchen, which is covered with sheaves of paper full of scribbles and crossings out.
"You're home early. I've just put the kettle on."
Jessie walks over to the hob.
"Good. I could use a cup of tea."
She takes the whistling kettle off the hob and prepares a pot of tea. She sets the teapot and two teacups on the table with a milk jug and a sugar bowl.
"What are you doing?" "I contacted Millicent Fawcett to see if there was anything I could do. She's proposed that we work on organising another march this summer. She's calling it a Woman's Right to Serve March. What do you think of this for the lead banner? Shells made by a wife may save her husband's life."
"Sounds good to me." Celie shuffles through the papers and picks out a photograph of a young female conductor checking tickets on a tram. She hands it to Jessie.
"If this war goes on, companies won't be able to ignore the necessity of employing women to work as conductors or clerical workers or even munitions workers. When the war is over, the government will have no choice but to give women the vote."
"Where did you get this?"
"I took it. She was working on one of the trams in Oxford Street.
Papa gave me his reflex camera to use while I'm working as his assistant in the studio. That was awfully trusting of him. He treats his cameras like his children. He's been teaching me all sorts of tricks and techniques. So you're not going to be a German teacher after all, I take it. Celie sets down her pen. I don't know, Jessie. Who knows anything now? All I know is that when the war's over, I'm going to marry Max. Jessie sets down the photograph. Celie, if you'd seen those poor soldiers. We've been having ambulances arrive all week from Waterloo with casualties from a place called Wipers in France. Chlorine gas, Celie. The Germans are using chlorine gas on our soldiers. It's pronounced Ypres. I've been reading about it in the papers. Ypres, then. I saw Frank Jeffries in the hospital today. Our Frank Jeffries? Jessie nods. What's happened to him? He was gassed. He has burns all over his hands and face. Good heavens, that's awful. He's coughing terribly. What sort of monsters would do such a thing? I don't imagine the German soldiers had much of a choice. They're just pawns in this whole exercise, just as much as our British boys are. Jessie slams her hand on the table. How can you say that, Celie? My own sister, a German sympathiser. Jessie! Well, it's true, isn't it? I'm not a German sympathiser. I love a German man. How do you think I feel? Don't you think I know what people would say if they knew about Max? I can't talk about him. I can't write to him. Her voice breaks. Jessie, I don't even know if he's still alive. Fury boils up through Jessie's body. The anguished moans of her patients, their racking coughs that stain the pillowcases pink with blood and saliva, the mourning for arms and legs lost to the French mud, the weeping of boys and men who have seen things no person should ever see. All these roll around her mind in a tumultuous whirl. Jessie drops the teaspoon into her teacup and pushes away from the table. Maybe it would be better for all of us if he were dead. 2 days later, Jessie is summoned to matron's office. The matron looks up from her desk as she arrives and nods at a wooden chair. Sit. Jessie sits down and tucks her ankles together. The matron eyes Jessie across the desk. Sister Fry, your actions with regards to Corporal Jeffries were the height of both insolence and insubordination. You exhibited a wilfulness and disregard for orders that I find quite astonishing. To lie so blatantly to an orderly using my name. In any other circumstances, you would be out without a reference. Do you understand? Yes, matron. However, the circumstances are not normal. It is quite wrong for a hospital to have perfectly good empty beds when sick and injured soldiers are being left in hallways. Your instincts were correct, although your execution was outrageous. Would you agree? Yes, matron, but I was afraid if I asked permission, I would have been refused. You most certainly would have been refused. However, your action highlighted a flaw in the hospital's protocol, which we have now addressed. In future, the beds in the private rooms will be used by any soldier who requires a bed, officer or not.
Oh, thank you, matron.
Let me say one thing, Sister Fry. I would caution you about your extreme willfulness. Nursing requires compassion and collaboration. We are here to support, not lead. Is that clear?
Yes, matron.
The matron nods. Now, to another matter. The Queen Alexandras have been requested to send nurses out to Egypt to nurse on the hospital ships in the Mediterranean. I'm sure you are aware that the Ottoman Empire has joined with the Austrians and Germans against the Allied forces. Fighting in the region has been extremely severe, with significant casualties. I've written a recommendation for you to join one of our hospital ships out of Alexandria. Jessie's heart leaps.
Me?
The matron leans forward and steeples her hands on her desk. The army requires nurses with a certain quality of stamina, of fortitude, and indeed of stubbornness in the face of adversity. I believe it may suit your character. You will be far from home for some time, possibly years. You will see things you will wish you had never seen. You will work long hours in conditions which may be, she shakes her head, which will be extremely challenging. You will be the face of the mother, the sister, the fiancée, or the wife of a man who is dying. You may well be the last face he sees. Do you understand, Sister Fry?
Yes, matron.
The matron opens up a manila folder. She unscrews the cap of a black fountain pen. Sister Fry, do you wish to undertake this assignment? I'm afraid I need your answer immediately, owing to the urgency of the situation. Jessie looks at the pen, poised like a dart in the matron's long fingers.
Yes. Yes, I'll go.
The matron nods. She signs the bottom of a document with a quick flourish. You've said you wish to travel and see the world, Sister Fry. I hope you won't regret it. She shuts the folder. The ship will be leaving Plymouth a week Monday. You'd best inform your family. Jessie hurries up the stairs to the private rooms on the hospital's first floor. She stops abruptly in the doorway to Frank Jeffrey's room. Celie sits on a chair beside Frank's bed, and Frank is propped up against his pillow, about to play a card onto the metal dinner tray in his lap.
Celie, what are you doing here?
Celie looks over at her sister.
Hello, Jessie. I decided to pay Mr. Jeffreys, I'm sorry, Corporal Jeffreys, a visit. He's trouncing me at Hearts.
Frank waves a bandaged hand at Jessie.
I hope you didn't get into too much trouble moving me up here, Jessie. I was getting awfully bashed about with that swing door in the hallway.
No, it's fine.
She glances at Celie. It's the least I can do for one of our brave soldiers.
I'm sure any soldier would appreciate some pleasant company in their hour of need, Celie says.
Absolutely, Miss Fry, Frank says.
But please, I'm Frank. Then you must call me Celie.
He hunches forward, dropping his cards over the sheets as he's racked with a fit of coughing. Jessie reaches into her chatelaine and removes a small glass vial and a spoon.
Time for your morphine, Frank.
She measures out a spoonful of liquid morphine, which Frank swallows gratefully.
Thank you, Jessie. I don't think I'd be able to manage without that.
I'll be sure that the doctor provides you with a supply of morphine when you're released. You'd best finish your card game before it takes effect. Celie likes to win.
Jessie, wait!
Jessie turns around to see Celie hurrying down the hospital hallway toward her.
What is it?
Jessie, we need to stop this.
Stop what?
You know what I'm talking about.
Jessie shrugs.
I think I'm justified in my opinion about your German fiancé, if it were me.
But it's not you, is it? It's my life. I love Max. I want to be his wife.
Good luck living in Britain with a German husband, Celie. I don't expect it'll be any easier living in Germany, what with you being British.
Have you thought about that? We'll find a way. Perhaps we'll emigrate to Australia or Canada.
That's a good idea, because you won't be welcome here in London. I'm simply warning you.
Fine. Noted. How can you marry him, Celie? A German.
You saw Frank, with his burns and that horrible cough. He's not the worst by far.
Don't you think I'm torn up about this? You're my sister, Jessie. Why can't you give me some support? I'm sure Etta would understand.
Etta? She's thoughtless and irresponsible. Imagine eloping to Italy in the middle of a war. Has she considered the worry she's caused Mama and Papa?
I fail entirely to understand either of you.
At least the Italians have finally joined our side.
I don't think I could bear having two sisters with... Jessie clamps her mouth shut.
With what, Jessie?
With enemy husbands. Celie pulls on her gloves.
How are we meant to live together, if that's how you feel?
I shouldn't worry about it, Celie. I'm being shipped out to Egypt in a fortnight. One of us Fry sisters will be doing her bit for the war.
I am doing my bit for the war. I'm organizing a march.
You and your marches. Shy little Celie coming out of her shell. Bully for you.
Nursing isn't the only way a woman can contribute to the war effort.
I don't care what you do, Celie. It's of no consequence to me.
Have you told Mama and Papa that you're going to Egypt? They'll be worried sick.
You can be sure Mama will do anything to stop you. It doesn't matter what they think. I'm going, and God help anyone who tries to stop me.
Chapter 33. Christina. Capri, Italy. March 1892. The path to the grotto is still slippery from the rain that showered the mountainsides and alleyways of the island through the dreary, cold month of February. Christina steadies herself by clinging to the rocky face of the cliff, slipping only once. The jolt shakes her and sets the baby turning inside her swollen belly. When she reaches the limestone arch of the Arco Naturale, she sits on a stone and rests for a quarter of an hour. She lifts her face to the warm caress of the sun's rays and shuts her eyes to listen to the waves and the cries of the gulls until the sickening swoops of anxiety that have plagued her since Harry's abandonment settle. By the time she descends the final stone step to the grotto, the morning haze has been replaced by an unseasonable midday heat that causes sweat to dampen her armpits and the tender skin under the high collar of the dress. She climbs the steps into the shade of the grotto and sits on the ruins of a cobbled wall. Framed by the cave's arch, the turquoise water of the Tyrrhenian Sea glistens before her. In the distance, the scrub-covered ridges and mountains of the Amalfi Coast rise into the blue March sky. The darkness that has hovered over her since Harry's departure descends like grey ash.
How can she face her father with her shame?
She is thankful that her mother hadn't lived to see her ruin. The baby kicks, and Christina rests her hand on the round bump.
You are a child of love, little one. At least, that's what I thought.
Christina's shoulders slump under the weight of her depression.
I was foolish. I thought your father loved me. But how could he have loved me, if he could abandon us like this? The world is a cruel place for people like us, little one. I won't be a foolish woman with a fatherless child. I shall not bring you into a world where you will be ridiculed because of your mother's folly.
Christina rises and walks down the grotto steps into the bright sunlight. For a moment, she is dazzled by the abrupt change, and she sways on the path. She reaches out to steady herself against an ancient cobbled wall and looks out at the sunlight sparkling like crystals on the blue sea. She steps off the path onto a strip of scrub grass.
Two more steps, then it will be done.
She makes the sign of the cross.
Heavenly Father, forgive me for what I am about to do and spare my poor child your wrath.
A hand closes around her arm. She turns to see Angelo's dark brown eyes shining with compassion in his weathered face.
No, signorina, it is not your time.
Today is a day to live.
Chapter 34. Etta, Naples, Italy, May 1915. Etta pegs the last of the washing onto the clothesline, which spans the narrow street, along with the hundreds of other clotheslines that form a permanent grid of rope over the streets and alleys of Naples. Today, is washing day, and clothes and sheets flap from the lines like colourful flags, throwing shadows onto the hot pavement. After 6 months in Carlo's one-bedroom flat above a cobbler's shop, she has become accustomed to the weekly routines, punctuated by the almost constant ringing of church bells. She rolls her head and presses her hands into the small of her back.
Less than a fortnight now. Not much time left to get married before you arrive, little one. Don't worry. Your papa has promised. It surely will be any day now. Then we shall be a proper family.
The door to the flat slams, and she hears the stamp of Carlo's boots on the tiled floor of the main room.
Etta? Out here, on the balcony.
She turns to greet Carlo, but freezes at the sight of him standing in the doorway in the high-collared grey-green uniform of the Italian army.
Carlo, what have you done?
His eyes shine at her from beneath the brim of his flat-crowned hat. I am so sorry, Etta. I had to. Her legs begin to shake, and she clutches at the rusty balcony railing.
But the baby's coming any time.
Carlo crosses the threshold and takes her hands in his. Their warmth spreads into hers, which is still icy from the wet laundry.
I know, cara mia. But since Italy declared war against the Central Powers on Sunday, you must have known this was coming. I'm an Italian. I must fight for my country.
Etta runs a hand over her belly.
What about the baby? What am I to do? What about the wedding?
Carlo drops her hands.
It must wait, Angelo mio. I must report to my regiment this afternoon. They are sending us to the mountains near the Austro-Hungarian border. I don't know how long I shall be gone. The war. Who can know what's happening? Hopefully, I shall be back here soon. Then we shall marry, I promise, and it will be the happiest day of my life.
But the baby won't have a father. It won't have a name, Carlo.
Of course it will. I am the father. It is our child, cara mia.
He takes hold of her arms.
Etta, I shall never abandon you. You must believe me. I shall come back.
Why haven't we already married?
Carlo turns away.
I have had to organize some things, and I must earn money for a family. You see how I have been living? I am an artist. I had no need for anything more than a bed and a table and a room to paint in. This is not acceptable for you and our child. I want to bring my wife to a proper home on our wedding day.
I don't care about any of that. I just want to marry you and be a family.
But I care, cara mia. Come, sit. I shall make a tisana.
Etta sits in one of the two mismatched dining chairs at the small wooden table. She watches Carlo as he moves around the stove and sink as he prepares the tea. As long as he is here, filling the small, musty rooms with his presence, she is able to dampen down the worry that has threatened to grow like a weed in her mind. She has told no one about the baby in the letters she has sent off to London. She had apologised for her impetuosity and had blamed the quick-moving developments of the war on her decision to elope to Italy with Carlo. She and Carlo had married, she'd lied, in a beautiful ceremony in the church of St. Anna dei Lombardi in Naples, with his loving parents in attendance. She was a married woman now, living in a beautiful home in Naples near his parents' villa. It was everything she'd ever wished for. If only it were true. Carlo sets a cup of fragrant fennel and thyme tea in front of Etta. He pulls out the second chair and tosses his hat on the table.
Etta, here's what you must do. You must send your cousin in Capri a message that you are living in Napoli with your Italian husband, and that he has had to leave with the army. Tell her you are expecting our first child shortly. Ask to go to her.
But Carlo, I don't know her. What if she says no?
She will never say no. She is Italian, and you are her family. She will welcome you a braccia aperte, with the open arms. Go to her and stay with her until I come back for you, cara mia. Then we shall marry and be a family. I promise you this with all my heart.
Chapter 35. Etta. Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy, June 1915. Stefania enters the airy interior of the sitting room in Villa Serenissima, just as Liliana appears from the kitchen carrying a tray of coffee, milk, freshly baked rolls, pats of cold butter, and a dish of grape jam.
"Here, Liliana," Stefania says. "Let me take it. I see she's out on the balcony with the baby."
Liliana releases the tray into Stefania's hands.
"Her milk has come, finally. She seems much happier today."
"Good. I still don't understand what happened. Everything seemed perfect after the birth. Then, the next day, rejecting her own baby like that."
Liliana shrugs.
"It happens sometimes. My daughter-in-law sat in her bedroom and cried for a month after Mario's birth. But it passes."
"Yes. Well, tell Elisabetta we won't be needing her milk any longer. Pay her a little extra for her services. Send Mario to the market to buy some fish for dinner and some cannoli from the pasticceria. Make sure he counts the change."
Stefania sweeps through the double French doors out into the cool shade of the balcony. The air is heavy with the perfume of climbing roses and jasmine, and early clusters of unripe grapes hang like green pearls from the overhead trellises. Etta sits in a wicker chair by the table, the baby suckling at her breast.
"Good morning, cara mia. You look much recovered."
"I am much better, thank you, cousin Stefania. Isn't it a lovely day? Oh, ouch! Careful, Adriana. I'm glad you don't have teeth yet."
"You will both become used to it soon enough, I'm sure."
Etta watches Stefania pour the milky coffee. The older woman, though not tall, carries herself with an elegance which belies the sturdiness and age of her 68-year-old body. Her dark hair, almost black, shines with threads of silver and is arranged in an unfashionable pompadour.
"Cousin Stefania, I'm so sorry about everything. I don't know what came over me. I felt so heavy, like an elephant was sitting on my chest. I could barely find the energy to lift my head. Even if I could, it wouldn't have done any good. It felt like it was packed with cotton wool."
Stefania pushes the coffee cup across the table.
"But you are feeling better today?"
"Oh, yes. I wrote Mama and Papa a letter this morning, telling them about Adriana. I'll write Carlo after the baby's fed."
She frowns.
"I don't know how to send him the letter. He's in the 2nd Army, 13th Infantry Division. He wrote it down for me before he left."
"Give me the letter when you've written it. I shall speak to the mayor. I'm sure he will know how to ensure Carlo receives it."
She spreads one of Liliana's fresh rolls with butter and jam and hands it to Etta.
"Now, eat. You have a baby to feed."
Etta dips the pen into the inkwell and looks at the creamy sheet of Stefania's best stationery. Today, so unlike yesterday and the days before, she feels like all the world's joy throbs inside her body, straining to explode into a shower of jubilation. The energy buzzes into her fingers. She is an angel, a messenger of joy. How has she been blessed with such a gift as Adriana? How is it possible that she has such a wonderful husband as Carlo? Perhaps not a husband on paper yet, but truly a husband in every other sense of the word. Smiling, she bends over the paper.
"Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy, June 9th, 1915. My most darling husband, Carlo, oh my dearest, we have a beautiful daughter. I have named her Adriana Cristina. She was born on May the 30th,
just a week after you left. She has hair as golden as the sunrise and eyes as dark as chocolate. Truly, she is a gift of our love. I so wish you could see her. You would surely fall in love with her, as I have. Cousin Stefania and her housekeeper, Liliana, have been taking excellent care of me, so please don't worry about that. You were right to tell me to come here. On this island, it is easy to pretend the war doesn't exist, with the beautiful skies and sea and the scent of roses and jasmine. How I wish you were here, my darling. How I wish to hold you in my arms again. I shall paint a portrait of Adriana for you and give it to you when you come. When I'm feeling better, I shall go for a walk and find a pretty church for us to marry in. Then, such a happy little family we shall all be. Perhaps we could find a small house here in Capri, with a lemon tree in the garden, and roses, of course, and a view of the blue, blue sea. We can start all over here, after the war. You and I and Adriana, and we can paint and drink lemonade and be so very happy, without a care in the world. I am sending you all my kisses. We are both waiting for you. Your loving wife, Etta. She sits back in the chair and folds the letter. A dull ache has begun to form at the back of her head. She rubs at the ache and blinks. A circle of zigzagging colours forms in her vision, shimmering like the kaleidoscope she'd owned as a child. She closes her eyes and sits as still as a stone until the zigzags strobe against her eyelids. The headache spreads up the back of her head to press against her forehead. She clutches onto the desk until the shimmering zigzags gradually fade away. Etta opens her eyes. She picks up the pen and dips it into the inkwell. Her hand shakes, and she takes several deep breaths to calm her racing heart. Sergeant Carlo Marinetti, 2nd Army, 13th Infantry Division, Italy, she writes. She slides the letter into the envelope and, dipping her finger into her water glass, moistens the gummed edge. She seals it shut as the cotton wool fills her throbbing head. Chapter 36. Jesse. Port of Alexandria, Egypt. July 1915. The HMHS Letitia sits alongside the dock, dwarfed by the grey-painted hulks of battleships being loaded with sacks of provisions and ammunition from the railway trolleys on the supply line which runs along the port of Alexandria. Horses stand patiently queuing in the burning sun, flicking at flies with their long tails as they await their turns to embark for the Gallipoli Peninsula on the eastern Turkish coast. Jessie picks up her new leather suitcase, a parting gift from her parents, and, adjusting her straw hat, hastens past the horses and the crowds of raucous Australian and New Zealand soldiers towards the large white hospital ship, with green crosses painted along its hull. She steps onto the wooden gangway and, with one last backward glance at the teeming port, heads up onto the ship.
Lovely, isn't it? You'd never know there's a war on, would you?
Jessie looks over at the plump young brunette nurse who has joined her at the ship's railing. She has a wide, high-cheeked face and mud-brown eyes, and she wears the short scallop cape and grey cotton dress of the Australian Army Nursing Service. Jessie nods. All these islands, with their charming fishing villages, and this turquoise sea. It's all so idyllic. She smiles and extends her hand. I'm Jessie Fry, with the Queen Alexandra's.
Ivy Roach, A-A-N-S.
Yeah, like the cockroach. The girl brushes her flapping white nurse's veil out of her eyes.
I'm thinking of changing it to De La Roche. Nice ring to it, don't you think?
Couldn't do it when I lived at home, of course. Pa'd have a fit.
Now I'm out here, I reckon I can do what I like. Ivy De La Roche, that's the new me.
Were you a nurse in Australia before the war?
Yeah, at the Royal Melbourne. Did a bit of everything there. Still, when the chance came to head out of Australia, I jumped at it. I've been to Malta and Cairo already. Had a ride on a camel to the pyramids. I highly recommend that, though you'll be batting off blokes running after you, selling tat all the way to the Sphinx.
I'd love to see the Sphinx. We had a stopover in Malta for a day, on our way down from England. I had an ice cream in the Baraka Gardens. It was lovely. I've always wanted to get out of Britain and see the world.
Ivy looks out at the craggy coastline of yet another sun-drenched island.
Yeah, shame it has to be under these circumstances. I met a nurse at the pyramids who'd just been transferred to the hospital at Abbasia, just outside of Cairo. She'd been on the HMHS Assay for 4 months. Said Gallipoli was an awful place. Said she scratched herself raw from the fleas and crawlers that came over from the mainland with the wounded.
I brought lye soap, just in case. My matron was a nurse in the Boer War. She warned me about fleas and lice.
Ivy's face breaks into a toothy grin.
Why didn't I think of that?
You'll be the most popular nurse on the ship. Dibs on being your best mate.
Jessie laughs.
Sure.
I'm going to head down to the mess with some tea. Do you want to come?
Not just now, thanks.
Sure thing. Catch you later.
Jessie watches Ivy march down the deck and disappear through a doorway into the ship's mess. She turns back to the view of the island, slipping quickly past the port side of the ship. The blue-green waves ripple and crest in the gentle breeze, and a small, bright blue fishing boat comes into view. Jessie waves at the two fishermen, and they wave back. She has no idea if they are Greeks or Turks. She grasps hold of the white metal railing as the ship lurches over a wave.
What if they were Turks?
The Turks, who are even now blowing the British, Australians, New Zealanders and Newfoundlanders to pieces down the Turkish coast at Gallipoli.
It wouldn't do to think about it. Life is easier if you keep an eye on the line in the sand.
There's our side, and there's the enemy side. Us and them.
Seely would do well to understand that. Max is on the enemy side.
Chapter 37 Christina Clover Bar, London, July 1915. Christina collects the post from the black and white tiled floor under the letterbox and sifts through the stack. She slips a thin white envelope with several Italian postage stamps to the top of the pile. She stops in the doorway of Gerald's study. He is seated in the green leather chair at her father's large mahogany desk, engrossed in the London Illustrated News. She deposits the post on the desk, keeping hold of Etta's letter.
"We've just had a letter from Etta."
Gerald looks up, his blue-grey eyes almost colourless behind his spectacles.
"That's wonderful. I've been worried about her. It's postmarked the 15th of June. The ships from Italy take so long now. I suppose we should be thankful we're receiving them at all. It's not like poor Seely with Max. She hasn't a hope to hear from him until after the war."
Christina sits in the mahogany chair opposite the desk.
"Seely can expect nothing but grief and obstructions if she marries a German. We can't possibly permit the match, Gerald."
Gerald removes his spectacles and, after folding them carefully, places them on top of the newspaper.
"I'm afraid I must disagree with you, my dear. Seely is a grown woman, and Mr. Fisher appears to me to be a fine young man. I'm not going to be one of the obstructions to her happiness."
"But, Gerald, the neighbours will simply have to mind their own business. She will be ostracised."
"Tina, you can't protect the girls from life. They will have to face challenges, just as we have. You must let go and trust them, or you will lose them, my love. I know that's the last thing you'd wish."
"I simply don't want the girls to be hurt, Gerald. Is that so wrong?"
"Of course not, Tina. You know, you should tell them you love them from time to time."
"Of course I love them. I'm their mother."
"Sometimes it's nice to hear it."
He puts his spectacles back on and picks up the newspaper.
I've been reading about the Gallipoli campaign, thinking about Jesse out there. I can't bear this war. Whatever are we doing in Turkey, of all places? Well, the Russian Tsar requested our help because of the Ottoman interest in the Caucasus, and we're ally to them, so I don't want to hear about it, Gerald. It's like a game of noughts and crosses to me. Politicians and generals playing games with the lives of young men. And now young women like our Jessica, from the safety of their offices. Perhaps Lord Sherbrooke shouldn't have been so vocal in his support of Churchill's plan to send our navy to Turkey to take Constantinople. He said Turkey was the sick man of Europe, and it would be a simple thing to knock it out. He's quite the orator, that Sherbrooke. He swung the support in the House of Lords, but it's been an absolute folly. 45,000 casualties on our side, and it's still going on. It's a wonder he and Churchill can sleep at night. I don't want to hear about Lord Sherbrooke or Gallipoli. Of course, Tina. Though, speaking of Sherbrooke, he's divorcing again. It's in the papers today.
Christina's heart jolts. Didn't he divorce his wife just last autumn to marry a dancer or some such?
He does seem to run through women. I expect we'll hear of another marriage before the year's end.
Had she simply been one of a long string of women Harry had loved and discarded, like a used shirt? But she meant nothing to him at all. Gerald gestures to the envelope that Christina is still holding.
What has Etta to say?
She looks down at the envelope. Of course. She slits through the envelope with Gerald's brass letter opener.
Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy, June 15th, 1915. My dearest Mamma and Papa, I am so very sorry not to have written sooner, but everything has been so very hectic here these past few months. Carlo joined the army in May. He has been sent to the mountains in the north of Italy, where they border Austria-Hungary. It wrenched my heart to see him go, as you can imagine, and me, left behind in Naples, with a baby on the way. I should have told you sooner, I know. I suppose I felt that I'd given you enough of a shock with the elopement. Truthfully, I have been somewhat unwell, although I am feeling much better now. At any rate, you will see from the address above that I am with Cousin Stefania in her lovely villa in Capri. It's a beautiful place, Mamma, with a balcony that faces out to the sea. I'm sure you would love it as much as I, if you were ever to visit. Cousin Stefania is so very kind. She's quite plump and not much taller than my shoulders, and she has a lovely housekeeper named Liliana, who must be nearly 70, though she's here every morning by 6, baking bread and ordering around her grandson Mario, who tends the garden since her husband passed 2 years ago. We are a jolly little group, especially now that we have a new addition. This is my news. I've had the baby. She is a sweet little thing that I've named Adriana Christina. Adriana after the Adriatic Sea, and Christina after you, of course, Mamma. You and Papa are grandparents. She was born on Sunday, May the 30th. The child who is born on the Sabbath day is bonny and blithe and merry and gay. Do you remember that rhyme? She is all of these things. She's as sunny as the month of her birth, with a smile that melts your heart, eyes as dark as the night sky, and a head of golden curls. I shall stay here at the villa until Carlo returns, so please don't worry about me. Adriana and I are in the best of hands. I've drawn you a picture of Adriana, so you can see your first grandchild's sweet face. I shall write again soon. With all our love, Etta and Adriana.
Christina unfolds the sketch of Adriana. The child's smiling, chubby-cheeked face is crowned with yellow curls, and her dark eyes shine in joyful amusement. A sob rises in Christina's throat as the memories of those first days with Cecilia rush into her mind. She presses her lips together and gives Gerald the drawing.
Isn't she lovely, Tina? She looks just like Etta did when she was a baby.
Etta's eyes are hazel,
Hers are brown. They must be her papa's eyes.
Christina rises abruptly.
Frame it and put it on your desk. You don't want to put it in the sitting room with the family photographs. I can always come in here if I wish to see it.
Harry Grenville's painting of Christina lies unrolled on the white crocheted bed cover. Christina sits on the bed beside it, examining the face of the girl in the painting, forever looking out over the blue sea as her lover paints her picture on a grassy hillside in Capri. Was she ever that happy, that hopeful? Harold Grenville, Lord Sherbrooke, I'm glad you can't stay married. I'm glad you have no other children. The two things Harry had left her, the painting and Cecilia, though Cecilia will never know the truth. No one but Stefania, Liliana, Aunt Henrietta, and Harry, of course, knows the truth of that summer in Capri. Not even Gerald. Now here is Etta, in Villa Serenissima, with a baby daughter in her arms and a husband away fighting a hideous war. Christina supposes she should be thankful that Etta and Carlo had married, even if it had been an elopement. She would never wish her situation in those lonely, anguished days and months after Harry's abandonment on anyone, least of all one of her daughters. But now, with that drawing of Adriana with her father's eyes, all the memories are flooding back. She can't have that. She can't bear it. Guilt tweaks her conscience. She should have told Gerald the truth before their marriage, that she wasn't really a widow, that the story of her young Italian husband's drowning was fabricated by her father to hide the shame of her situation when she'd returned with Cecilia from Italy. Now, it's simply too late. Gerald must never know about what happened between her and Harry Grenville, Lord Sherbrooke. And Cecilia must never know that Gerald isn't her father. Gerald has kept his word about that. It would never do to have Cecilia dig into a past that is nothing more than a mirage. To find out that she had been a terrible mistake. Maybe the Heavenly Father has sent Max Fisher to take Cecilia away, to relieve Christina of the burden of her guilt whenever she looks at her eldest daughter. There is still one problem to be resolved. Cecilia's birth certificate, or rather, the lack of one. There had been an Italian one, of course, with Harry's name on it, but that is with Stefania in Capri. How is she to obtain a British birth certificate for her daughter, with Gerald's name on it, and the amended birth date? Cecilia must never know she is a year older than she believes. It is best that everything continues just as it has since the day of her marriage to Gerald. She runs her fingers along the outline of the girl's face in the painting. Thank heaven for Stefania. She will take care of Etta and her baby, the way she took care of herself in the bleak days after Cecilia's birth. The days when, in the delirium of the fever that took hold of her, all she had wanted to do was walk into the sea until it closed over her head. She rolls up the painting and wraps it in the brown paper, securing it with string. She slides it onto the top wardrobe shelf, behind her hat boxes, gloves and scarves, and the green leather diary, where she knows Gerald will never find it. Chapter 38. Seeley. London, July 1915. Seeley shrugs into her raincoat and adjusts her navy straw hat, which she's adorned with patriotic red, white and blue rosettes, in the mirror. A movement catches her eye. Millie is watching her from the sitting room, a feather duster in her hand.
Millie, isn't this your day off?
Half day, miss. Mrs. Fry says I'm needed to help her keep the house right, with the Red Cross ladies coming tomorrow to knit.
Mama shouldn't take your half day away from you. I'll have a word with her.
Oh, no, miss, don't bother her. Knitting for our boys in France is important.
Celie fastens the tiny pearl buttons of her gloves.
Millie, have you heard about the Women's Right to Serve demonstration?
A quick bob of her capped head.
Yes, miss. In the Suffragette. You read the Suffragette?
Millie twists the feather duster nervously in her hands.
I'm sorry, miss. Am I not meant to? Oh, heavens no. I mean, you may read whatever you wish, Millie. I had no idea you were interested in the suffragist cause. Oh, yes, miss. I've seen you at some of the meetings at Blackie Falls.
Her face freezes.
On my days off. I haven't been skiving. You should have said hello. Didn't think it was my place, miss.
Celie frowns at Millie's pale, sharp-chinned face. She pulls a green umbrella out of the stand and holds it out to the girl.
Put on your raincoat. I have a banner to hold up during the march. Why don't you come and help me? What about Mrs. Fry? I wouldn't want her to be cross. I shall speak to Mama later. Come on then, Miss Smith. We have work to do.
Celie stands beside Millie, who is wildly waving their banner in front of a large plywood platform which has been erected beside Landseer's bronze lions in Trafalgar Square. She takes the Soho reflex camera out of her canvas bag, loads a roll of film, and clicks pictures of Millie's excited face, the reporters in bowler hats and raincoats sitting on collapsible stools in front of the stage, and the bobbies in their navy uniforms and egg-shaped helmets doing their best to hold back the vocal crowd. The huge square is massed with people, both women and men, who spill out onto the surrounding streets. The red, white and blue rosettes on the women's hats bob like ducks on the Thames. She focuses the lens on Emmeline Pankhurst as the woman stirs the crowd with her impassioned speech.
I have been thrilled at the enthusiasm expressed by the thousands of women, some of whom have attended many suffragist rallies, and some who have joined a march for the first time. I've also heard the scoffs of some of our spectators.
A rumble ripples through the crowd.
Yes, the scoffs of some of the spectators who have raised objections to women joining the workforce in our munitions factories. I heard one man say that it was nonsense, as the factories would be required to build lavatories for the women.
The crowd bursts into laughter, and someone whistles.
How can we say to our grandchildren that we lost the war because the factory owners refused to build women's lavatories? Imagine that! The war lost for want of lavatories. I think this is a surmountable problem, wouldn't you agree?
The crowd roars like a great awakening beast. Celie scans the faces with the camera, clicking until she comes to the end of the roll of film. She digs into her pocket and changes the film, then focuses the lens once more on the women on the stage. Her heart pounds as she listens to the speech, aware that history is unfolding in front of her eyes, a history that she can catch with her camera. Emmeline Pankhurst moves across the stage, thrusting her hand into the air to emphasise her words.
What we women are marching for today is to be given the opportunity to do something meaningful for the war, and to be paid a living wage to do so. We are strong. We are capable. My message to the factory owners, and I know some of you are here today, is to employ us. My message to the women here today is to sign up to the National War Register so you can be called upon in our country's hour of need. If our men must go to war, we must do our utmost to fill their places in all the existing munitions factories. We must be ready in every city, at every bank till, on every train or tram, behind every desk, as men respond to our country's call. Let us serve!
The square erupts into thundering shouts and applause. A hand squeezes her arm. She looks into Millie's clear green eyes.
I should like to do something for them poor soldiers, wouldn't you, Miss Fry?
Millie points at Celia's camera.
You should send your pictures to the papers. A picture's worth a thousand words. That's what me pa always says.
Celia looks at the camera.
Could she do that? Would anyone be interested in pictures taken by a woman? You should do it, miss. I would if I was you.
Maybe Millie is right. Maybe it's time to put herself out there, to find her life, the way that Jessie and Etta have found theirs. No one wants a German teacher. Even the Translation Bureau isn't interested in her. But photography, that's something she could do. She smiles at Millie.
What a wonderful idea, Millie. I believe I shall.